KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. The new documentary, Howard, produced by Don Hahn, is an intimate portrait of the life of lyricist Howard Ashman. Together with composer Alan Menken, Ashman wrote memorable songs for The Little Mermaid, Part of Your World, Under the Sea, Kiss the Girl. Just as that movie was being released, Ashman was diagnosed with AIDS. But he still wrote the lyrics for Beauty and the Beast and was working on that film from his hospital bed as he lay dying. As the producer of the 1991 animated classic film, Don Hahn was there. 5 years ago, it hit him that he needed to make the Howard documentary.
There was just some thing inside me that I just felt like this. Nobody's told this story. And I just thought, you know, I don't know if I'm the right person to do it, but I have access to all the tape. I knew where all the tape was. I knew where all the archival tape was. I knew all the people to talk to. And I thought, if I don't do this, I'll regret it for the rest of my life.
Hahn joins us along with Oscar-winning composer Alan Menken, who remembers a brilliant creative partnership that ended too soon. But first on the news banter, more upheaval in Hollywood. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Wow. So, you know, last week we bantered and then I had to record another update because we talked a little bit about this massive reorganization at NBC Universal, which had happened on the Monday of that week. And by Friday, we had a complete other massive reorganization at Warner Media, which they really dropped on people out of the blue. They moved Bob Greenblatt out as chairman of Warner Media Entertainment, a very big job. They moved Kevin Reilly out as he was in charge of various streaming stuff, as well as TNT and Turner Networks. They elevated Casey Bloys, the head of HBO, to run all kinds of content. And, you know, it's really striking to me that Jason Kyler is in charge of all of Warner Media. This was 3 months ago. He is a guy who worked at Hulu back in the day when Hulu was just being founded. He was the first head of Hulu. He was in a difficult position then because he had these studios that were, they were aware of the need to start streaming. They wanted to start streaming. They were scared to start streaming. So there was push and pull. And he left there a while ago and was kind of out there in the world. We're serving on the Univision board. He started a company that he then sold and vanished. I mean, from that, he goes to running this whole thing, CNN, HBO Max, you know, the Warner Brothers film and TV studios. That is a huge job for this guy. And he has now made big changes. As I said, putting Casey Bloys in charge of all of HBO Max streaming at HBO. That is a really big job, too. Casey Bloys had been running HBO, and he is someone that the community, I think, is relieved to see in a content job like that because he has connections to, you know, creators and talent and old school legacy media ways of dealing with creators and talent. They then elevated Ann Sarnoff, who had been running the film and TV studio, to be in charge. You know, she's actually the boss of Casey Bloys in that job. She has been around for about a year. She does not come from this world. She is considered to be a capable executive, but you know, getting to know Hollywood is not so simple. I think people will be looking to Casey as the guy who they know. These are very, very big changes. And what strikes me is all of these companies now, at a time when the pandemic is hitting, you know, and shutting things down, they are all chasing streaming as if it's a proven thing that will work for them. And I think it's a risky game.
Kevin Reilly, who was just fired from his job at Warner Media, said it best. He called it a reckoning. And he's saying, listen, we're competing against these streaming giants that do not have to show a big profit. And these are legacy media companies that have been managed to show profits every quarter and to increase those profits every quarter. They've done a great job at it, and it's really difficult to pivot here. And I think, you know, there's a surface thing going on here. Yes, there's reorganization. HBO had, you know, the launch of HBO Max was a mess. There's a lot of consumer confusion out there. There were a lot of different jobs and fiefdoms. So it does make sense on a surface level to consolidate those jobs. You know, Bob Greenblatt and Kevin Reilly just found themselves as the odd men out. But I think there's a larger issue at play here. And this is something that is going to strike fear into all aspects of Hollywood. And that is that from now on, or at least into the immediate future, there is going to be less emphasis on individual media brands within a larger media company and greater emphasis on how are we dominating the global streaming market. You're seeing it here at Warner Media. They're putting their mass amounts of resources into the HBO Max product. They're going to put less resources into everything else. You saw it at Disney, where they're putting all their resources into Disney Plus, and that's a big deal. I mean, this content studio plan they have, where they're going to get rid of all these different studio arms and consolidate into what I've called in the past a ghost kitchen approach to content making. You have one big studio, and then you make a bunch of stuff, and then you figure out where it goes in the distribution platforms. That's a big change from what Hollywood is used to, which is each individual outlet having its own identity, its own development, its own process.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from people saying that the agencies, which are also being hit by the pandemic, are leaning toward the streamers, of course, because then you get the cash. You get cash up front. You don't wait for a syndication deal or hope you get to 100 episodes or go through the windows. So there's pressure on the creatives to go towards streaming as well. Meanwhile, these companies, these legacy companies, they have old businesses, you know, things like broadcast television, NBC Network, whatever, that still throw off billions of dollars a year. So the simple task that's being set for these people is, we're going to slash your workforce, we're going to give you much less money to work with, but you've really got to produce more content. and meanwhile, while you're doing the streaming, please maintain these other businesses as long as they are throwing off this money. It's a really, I don't know how people are supposed to do these jobs. They're very difficult, but that is where we are. And I think that we're going to see people get, you know, there's going to be companies that get very hurt from this. And, you know, I had an executive tell me, an insider, that he doesn't believe there's a world where AT&T has the stomach to spend the billions of dollars needed to feed that streamer. When you see Netflix just throwing billions at content. Competing with that, you know, these companies were not built that way.
Well, and Netflix is not very profitable and has taken on mass amounts of debt in order to accumulate that content. And, you know, the jury's out as to whether that will ultimately be successful. A lot of people think it's going to be successful because the stock keeps going up and up and up. But, you know, can NBC Universal or AT&T and Warner Media, can they replicate that? I don't know. I mean, it's tough. I mean, Jason Kilar has said in interviews that this era is going to be about trying to be one of those five or six streaming services that ends up winning and ends up having an audience and dominating and becoming the new outlet for entertainment content. And it really is a battle for your living room. These entities want to be the pipeline through which you get everything.
Meanwhile, not in the living room, AMC Theaters, which has been really through it with the pandemic, all theaters have, but AMC in particular, its financial situation is perilous to the point where they actually agreed that Universal could have 17-day theatrical windows for certain movies. That's huge, huge concession. That made news. They are now saying they are determined to open theaters. They think that they can open more than 100. They have delayed in the past. They're trying to do this on August 20th, coming up soon. The first day, 15 cents. After that, $5 to see, you know, old movies. They don't have new product at this point. Things like Beauty and the Beast or Black Panther or Jumanji, old movies. And they're touting that they're going to have super cleaning and people are going to wear masks. And I don't know if they're going to wear masks eating popcorn, but that's what they're saying. And they're not going to go to capacity. All of this is this, you know, desperate hunger. Please, please let us have a business. And I don't blame them, but I don't know if it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, they claim that by Labor Day, when the Warner Brothers movie Tenet is supposed to come out, that they will have 2/3 of their theaters open. I think that's pretty optimistic. But even if they do, are people going to go to these theaters? And that's the big question. I just, you know, in certain areas of this country, you're not even allowed to eat dinner inside. So the idea of sitting in a darkened theater for 2 hours, you know, in close proximity to people is just not appealing, despite what cleaning procedures or masks, that whatever the theaters say they're going to offer. So, you know, I think that the real test here is going to come with Tenet, because they can offer free movies, which is essentially what the 15-cent thing is. They can put, Disney is putting New Mutants in theaters, which is a movie they don't really care about. It's a Fox leftover. They're putting that in theaters end of August. But Tenet is going to be the first A-list blockbuster style movie that comes out. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are corners of this country that see movie going as an extension of not wearing a mask in public, or, you know, showing your freedom to live as you want to live and going to a movie theater to enjoy your life. And I think there will be a certain amount of people that do that. The question is whether that can get to a number that Warner Brothers will be happy with, that they will say, oh, we're going to make our money back on this movie. So let's put some other movies on the schedule, like Wonder Woman or some of the other things that they have sitting there waiting like planes backed up to land. And I don't know if the number will get that high.
I kind of doubt it, but we will wait and see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Even if you don't recognize Howard Ashman's name, you must recognize his lyrics.
Tale as old as time, true as it can be.
What more is you looking for under the sea? Under the sea, darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me.
To keep it neat and clean in the pine soul scented air, somewhere that's
clean. Alan Menken and Howard Ashman started off Broadway. Their collaboration included the huge hit Little Shop of Horrors, which then led them to Disney. When they came on the scene, Disney Animation was adrift. With Little Mermaid, they helped propel the studio to a hit, soon followed by Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. But by the time the Beauty and the Beast theme song won an Academy Award in 1992, Ashman's Oscar for writing the lyrics was awarded posthumously. Don Hahn was the producer on Beauty and the Beast and labored on the film as Ashman became so sick that he could no longer keep his illness a secret as he had wished to do. Years later, Hahn started work on a documentary to introduce audiences to the man behind the lyrics, a story that he tells in the new Disney Plus documentary, Howard. The film includes archival footage and interviews with Ashman's partner and family, as well as his collaborators, foremost among them, Alan Menken. He and Ashman worked together starting in the late 70s, and as Menken recalls, their chemistry was quickly evident.
We just discovered that together we had a voice, you know, as a unit that, you know, was unique and powerful. And the effect that Howard had on me, you know, has lasted the rest of my life as far as the things he brought out in me in working with him. And I would like to think that, you know, there are things in working with me that came out in him. Yeah, but it was, I instantly knew the work was good, kind of amazing. And of course, with Little Shop especially, it was, that was such a unique blend of meat, of styles and vocabularies. And, you know, you got all the musical theater nuts and bolts, but within a cinematic context and a pop music context, and all of these elements married together.
I mean, we could do a whole interview on Little Shop, but we can't because we're not here to talk about that today. But obviously, you know, just one, a classic that is, I remember the stage version at my daughter's middle school. So it became one of those things, you know. Did Howard instantly say animation, or was he looking at things sort of, it could be anything?
He really had, Howard really gravitated towards animation. He loved, I mean, Howard was such a fan of Fairy Tale, for instance. And Howard once confessed to me, or because I was talking about how I could have done anything. This was before I knew he was sick, as I remember. But we were talking about our futures. And he said, you know what I'd love to do? I would love to start a children's theater group. And I was like, of all the things you could do with all the successes we've had, so much of his heart was in that. It's natural that he was drawn to animation.
Don, do you remember meeting me? I have to ask.
I remember talking to you for the first time, but it was on Roger Rabbit right before Beauty and the Beast.
Exactly. It was on Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if you remember.
Oh, I totally do. Yeah. You were like this force that came in from outside and everyone was like, who is this Kim Masters?
Yes, I was quite a nightmare on Roger Rabbit. So I just wanted to see if
we're still friends, nightmare. Though. It's okay.
It was fine. It was just a battle of how much access I would get, which does tie into Beauty and the Beast. Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was really finding his way with animation, you know, he'd done like Oliver and some things that were not the greatness of Little Mermaid. He was very not so sure. He wanted me running around talking to animators. Animators are very chatty, as you know, Don.
They're too chatty, yeah.
And he couldn't understand that. And the way it ties back to Beauty and the Beast is after I wrote about Roger Rabbit having sort of broken through all the barriers you guys put up, and it was a good story. Jeffrey let me run completely free on Beauty and the Beast and interview everybody. I said, why are you letting me walk around like this? And he said, because I know it will make the story better. So that is the connection. But so can you remember for me, Don, what it was like to meet this team of incredible, gifted lyricists and composers?
Well, I mean, yeah, for me, we were working on Beauty and the Beast in London with another director, and it was a very kind of, you know, beautiful European fairy tale, very Cocteau, very kind of uninteresting in the end. And we all saw it and said, you know, we really need Howard and Allen on this. Jeffrey actually did. He just said, you know, let's get them on it. And at the time, Mermaid was done. And so I think I met you guys when you were at the Mermaid Press Junket in Orlando, and I sat there with you, and we, you know, talked, and we were just like hoping against hope that you guys would sign on to it. And luckily for us, Aladdin had these huge story problems, so the amazing kind of work you were doing on Aladdin had to go on hold, and we were the beneficiaries of that. So that's how it all started.
Because you were in Beauty and the Beast. Let me roll back though, Alan. You meanwhile we're on this Little Mermaid Press Junket. Tell me about the making of Little Mermaid. You reveal in the film, I don't think I knew this, that Jeffrey Katzenberg actually wanted to cut part of your world as a song in that movie.
We would have our preview screenings along the way, and we had test audiences. And you obviously, with the animated movie, you watch for a young audience, and when the heads start to bob like popcorn in front of you, or they go, I got to go to the bathroom, you go, trouble. And we hit part of your world, and their heads were bobbing, and the kids, Jeffrey said, we're losing them at that moment, which was a logical conclusion. And we had to figure out what do we need to do to keep their attention. And it was very simple. Basically, because she wants to go on land, this is a great jeopardy, and we need somebody to be going, oh my God, this can't be happening, as she sings the song. Glenn Keane, I think, was credited with having the idea of having a cutaways to Sebastian watching this and being alarmed as she sings the song, which I'm sure helped. I think there could have been many ways to skin that cat. You always need to know what is happening while the song is being sung. How is it moving story forward, number one, and how is it being staged? What are we seeing? If you can answer those questions, you have a much better chance of the song actually remaining in the project. And so how Part of Your World would land was based on its not simply being Ariel in the grotto singing to the stars and saying, this is what I want. There has to be something that moves story forward and gives it some dramatic tension. And so that helped. And once we did that, the song was safe and remained in the picture.
Coming up after a short break, Don Hahn and Alan Menken tell the story of how they came to find out that Ashman was dying many years before his time. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Maybe he's right. Maybe there is something the matter with me.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to composer Alan Menken and director Don Hahn about Howard, a documentary about the life and work of the lyricist Howard Ashman. Together, Menken and Ashman came up with the songs that you know from Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin. Much of the work on Beauty and the Beast was done not in Los Angeles, but out of a Hudson Valley hotel outside New York City. Some of Ashman's collaborators on the film thought he was being a diva, demanding the production move close to his home. But Ashman had AIDS and was keeping his diagnosis a secret even from his close collaborator, Alan Menken. Ashman learned of his illness just as he and Menken were doing press for Little Mermaid.
I mean, he had just come from the doctor, and it's in the documentary, and he had just gotten the diagnosis. And I remembered being shocked that he was letting me handle most of the questions. He was being very quiet, but clearly this was shaking him to his core.
Of course, but you didn't know why.
Yeah, and so certainly during Little Mermaid, this was truly life and death to him. And until people at Disney knew that, I'm sure they just chalked it up to him being a difficult artist. And it took some, you know, massaging.
Don, you found footage of this evening at the 92nd Street Y where Alan and Howard are sitting there, and Howard knows he's been diagnosed with AIDS and Alan doesn't. That must have been a good discovery for you as a filmmaker, even though it's obviously an evening that was extremely sad.
It's always a treasure hunt on these movies trying to find tape like that. And nobody had videotaped it. And for a while, we thought nobody had recorded it. But then the 92nd Street Y came up with this tape that had been sitting on the shelf for 30 years and sent it to us. And it's you know, amazing. It's a great conversation, as you would think. But then Billy, Howard's partner, while I was interviewing him, he said, you know, he started looking at his calendars and stuff, and he said, I think that was around the same time Howard was diagnosed. And then we kind of added it all up and just thought, oh, man, that's like the same day. And that just is such a stomach punch, I think, to – you know, obviously to Howard and obviously to us as an audience to, you know, kind of see that juxtaposed on just trying to be in front of the public and say nice things. And
during that press junket, I mean, you talk about juxtapositions. This was Howard's first time at Disney World. And there we are being taken around the park and we're going on rides. And you can only imagine, no pun intended, the emotional roller coaster that Howard was on experiencing this. While, you know, the rug is being pulled out from under his life.
And you had no inkling at that point. He didn't seem unwell. He maybe seemed a bit peevish, more so than usual.
Yes, there was always a physical thing going on. I remember at the Oscars for Little Mermaid, supposedly Howard said, oh, I have a terrible hiatal hernia. And so I'm taking these medications, and I got to stay at the hotel, and that's why I've lost weight. And it was by the end of that night, though, we were sitting with the two Oscars, and he said, we have to have a talk. And I, you know, he decided he was going to tell me. But he still, at that point, was not going to tell people at Disney yet.
I mean, I don't know, Don, were people starting to chatter? And they must have seen he wasn't well at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, after a while, you just see him lose weight, and you, you know, start to add it all up. But and, you know, and we never talked about it in the room. I mean, people talk about, gee, did Howard write AIDS into the script? And this, and I mean, it was never, ever talked about. We never talked about his health. We just talked about work. He was so focused on the work and so professional that you just did that. And no, we were clueless.
I mean, by the end, he's in a hospital bed working and dying at the same time, which is –
Yeah, the last song we recorded was a song called Something There that's in the middle of Beauty and the Beast. And Alan's holding the phone out so that Howard can hear. And then Howard's just whispering to Alan, like, you know, have Paige try this. And, you know, trying to get the and directing from his hospital bed.
Paige was singing it new and a bit alarming. And Howard, to the other end of the phone, wanted to get this sort of new and a bit alarming. And he said, everyone had to be entirely silent in the studio. And he said, tell Paige, Streisand, alarming, Streisand, alarm. New and a bit alarming. And it was exactly what it had to be.
One of the most joyous parts of the film is when you guys are working the on Beauty and the Beast. You have Jerry Orbach and Angela Lansbury, and to watch them record, that was amazing. And was the footage for that easy to find?
Yeah, I knew we shot that day. In fact, I had to ask Howard if it was okay that we filmed that day because he was starting to look a little gaunt. And he said, yeah, that's fine. And so we didn't shoot that much. And I always knew the footage was there, but to pull it out and look at it again was really kind of thrilling because, again, there's no like nod to Howard being weak or sick or anything. It's just process. And he and Alan are in there with, you know, Danny Troob, their orchestrator, and David Friedman and the actors. And it's happening like this live, kind of Broadway cast album recording. And then I just wanted to put it in the movie as kind of this voyeuristic exercise just to say, you know, let's let the audience sit there in the room that I was lucky enough to be in and experience it for a while because it's instructive. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do the documentary was to have people understand the process and see Howard working and, watch him give direction to Jerry Orbach and you know, what is that like? And so I just found that clip kind of magical, even to the point of, you know, having Angela talk about her teapots and stuff. You can kind of tell the enthusiasm and the joy that was there during that day. And, you know, we had worked with those songs and storyboarded and animated those songs. And so this was like the final recording. And it just tells you so much about the energy and the drive and the fun of that day.
Yes, it really does. It comes through so strongly. So the idea for the doc, when did that start? I think it's been a while that you've labored to make this happen.
So about 4 years ago, I had a lunch with Sarah, Howard's sister, and it was like an innocent lunch. And about halfway through my cheeseburger, I just said, I think I have to make a movie about Howard. It was like an impulse buy, you know, like buying a stick of gum at the checkout counter. There was just some thing inside me that I just felt like nobody's told this story. And I just thought, you know, I don't know if I'm the right person to do it, but I have access to all the tape. I knew where all the tape was. I knew where all the archival tape was. I knew all the people to talk to. And I thought, if I don't do this, I'll regret it for the rest of my life. And so that was the start of 4 years of digging through the Library of Congress and taking a train up to, you know, Sarah's house and going through family photo albums. And all these people were so generous with me and so forthcoming with their stories about Howard. And that's how it started.
And Alan, did you feel that you were absolutely there for it? Or were you like, this is a very painful time in my life that I don't know if I want to revisit?
No, I was completely there for it. I mean, it's one of my huge life agendas to help sort of see through the unlived life of Howard and the work that we did and just his spirit is runs through everything I've done since then, as far as I'm concerned.
Alan Menken is a composer and songwriter who is a collaborator of Howard Ashman's. Don Hahn is the director of Howard. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.